Hey, welcome, welcome,
welcome,
welcome to the Marshaverse. This is a place in the rest of the universe where I come to make shit make sense. Marcia.
From the entertainment capital of the world, Las Vegas, Nevada, it's midnight in the Marshaverse, starring Marcia Warfield and her two sons, Stephen Roberts and Skills Hudson, as the problem child.
Good morning. Welcome to Midnight in the Marshaverse, where we like to get together at that witching hour between yesterday and tomorrow, which is when the spirits are at their peak and we're ready to tap into some women magic. Anyway, thank you for being here. We appreciate you. We're going to do something a little different this week. We have a wonderful guest. I'm so excited he's here. You're gonna have a ball with. I can say one thing, and I know it's gonna bother him, so I'm gonna say it now and get it out the way. Hey, you're gonna love him when he comes out. We're gonna talk about a whole lot of stuff, but right now we're gonna do our little ritual like we do, where we just chill. You know, this is usually not about gotcha and getcha. It's midnight. It's time to just relax, you know, whether you're sitting up in bed or stretched out on the couch or whether you're watching it tomorrow or next week sometime. It's a time in the week when you can just breathe, just chill. And I like to, this once a week, have a little cannabis and cognac because I like cognac and I like cannabis. I got into cognac thanks to Paul Mooney. He gave us all a lot of stuff, but he was the first one to get me to stop drinking scotch and milk when I was 22, 21, something like that, stupid as the day is long, and to start drinking cognac. And so tonight, because I'm feeling that away, I'm feeling upset and black, we're going to have some douce because it's the official drink of upset black people. And I'm going to have it. I'm not having it in a snifter or a pretty little glass. I'm feeling very upper ghetto. So I'm having it in my Marcia cup. So it's a nod to the cup, is a nod to the ghetto. And the cognac is a nod to the upper. I believe in reclaiming some words and rejecting others. I will reclaim the word ghetto, because to me, it just means home. You know, I'm from the south side of Chicago, and the south side of Chicago will always be in me. And upper, because, you know, in the black community, a lot of you might not know, as black people migrated up north, we were all supposed to live in the same area. So there were no really class separations that we were allowed by the larger society. We were just black. And so you would have doctors and lawyers and Pullman porters and preachers and all kind of upper crust black people living a block away from the projects. So everybody, and we all had family. Mixed family, whatever, whatever. So we had to make our own categories in the ghetto. We have low ghetto, upper ghetto, middle ghetto, country, and hood. Those are the, you know, our class, upper, low class, whatever designation. So I am upper ghetto, and I am having some cognac in a coffee cup. Yes, that's nice. I'm also having a little cognac. I like vapes. I don't like the scents. And it's a little stronger. I only have to hit it once, and I'm good. So this is a church battery and church cartridge. What it is, I don't know what strain, whatever. It's a sativa because I don't want to fall asleep. But I'm going to have a little bit of that. Okay, now I'm ready. I did not prepare for this week. You know, I usually prepare at least an outline of things I want to talk about. But I have been so just mad recently about the way things are going. in this country. And it's not that I didn't see it coming, but it's like, you know, when you see a car coming at you and you know it's coming and you just can't get out of the way in time. You hope it's going to stop and then it doesn't. And you just like a deer in the headlight. This current America we're living in has been predictable my whole life. And it has been simmering under the progress that came about in the 60s, 50s and 60s. I was born in 1954. I'm the same age as the civil rights movement. Black history is always truncated into segments. It's never seen as a continuum that has existed as long as we've been here, as long as American history has been here. And it's not segmented in reality. However, it's taught as if there were periods of blackness and then other periods of not. That's not true. We've been the nation's moral compass, the nation's conscience since the beginning. There has not been a time when black people have not tried to make America more equitable, more diverse, more inclusive. And if it had not been for that, we wouldn't be able to sit here tonight and have this discussion, to have this show. It's been a constant forward movement, and there's been a constant pushback. It's always been, we have lived under the umbrella of a white supremacist country that wants it to keep it that way. And even in my career, in everything, that consciousness has always been there. And so to see white supremacy bide its time over decades and 100 years until it got to the point where it could regain the stranglehold on American society that it has, and attempt to take us back to a time before the Civil War. This is a relitigation of the Civil War, and it wants to take us back there as if we didn't exist then, as if we weren't a part of American society somehow even then. But that's the whole game plan in a nutshell. Take America back, make America great. All that is just, let's get back to a time when white men ran everything, which accounts for why we saw the speeches that we saw today from Pete Hegseth and Donald Trump in front of the military. They made sit through this lecture and forced them to all get together, and they don't understand why nobody clapped, why nobody appreciated being there. That's the mindset of people who've never seen other people as human, has only seen them as pawns to be maneuvered around to their pleasure. And so we're in a situation where, from my point of view, as a old black lesbian woman, where you can see what's going on and not really be able to do anything about it. It's so incredibly frustrating. It's hard to put into words. You know, I started school in 1959, and back then it was altogether different than there was as I was growing up. From the time I remember television, there was the civil rights movement, there was hippie movement, an anti-war movement, women's movement, all of these groups and segments of society who wanted to be included too, gay rights. Everybody was trying to push toward a better America. And they did to a large degree. When I was a little girl, women couldn't get divorced. Women didn't have bank accounts. Women weren't able to get a diagnosis from their doctor without their husband's approval. There was just, it was a whole different country. And that didn't start to change until the 70s. And it was a sea change, women's lib. And there was a big movement to get the ERA passed. And at that time, the patriarchy of white America revved up to the top level that they could and barely suppressed that, but did suppress. They were one state or so away from getting the Equal Rights Amendment passed. And then there was all the Anita Bryant stuff. And it was a time. And you should, if you're not aware of it, look it up. But every time there was some sort of progress, there was a tremendous amount of pushback. For a long time, though, the pushback was stronger and strong enough to withhold the oppression. They hadn't really dug in. They've been, you know, planning this Project 2025, this current administration, this current white supremacist takeover of cities and put illegals in illegals, like people like you ain't illegal. I think the native people would have something to say about that. But this has been in the planning stages for a long time. And I've been trying to talk about it on stage through my stand-up. But that, you know, if you don't know, I took about 20 years off. And when I came back to doing stand-up, I had to start all over. I had no chops. I had no, you know, you don't keep your muscle memory. And plus, it's 20 years later. You're not the same person. You have a different mindset. You have to reinvent yourself. So, and that takes time. And the opportunities, now that I'm in my 70s, to be afforded the stage time to build that act has not really been there. So I've done a lot of stuff social media wise and everything, but not stand up. And I tried not to maybe go so deep into all of the things I wanted to put in a stand up performance until I had the opportunity to share the stage or to share myself on stage with just me for an hour and a half, you know, and which that's rare. And especially now that they've McDonaldized stand up and it's a whole different game, which is another thing I had to get used to when I came back, the whole, you know, different game that show business is, a lot of which is tied to technology. As technology changes, show business always changes. The means of showcasing performances changes with the technology. And so all of that together, and it's a whole lot of stuff I want to say that I can't pack into the time I have allotted, but trying to express that the best way I know how, which is through my stand-up, has been frustrating. You know, I haven't really been able to crack that nut for whatever reasons. You know, they're, like I said before, I'm a old gay black woman in my 70s. You know, there just don't seem to be a, you know, a big clamoring for people to want to come out in the evening and spend an hour or two with me. But be that as it may, I've been talking about how this was inevitable for years and years, because I could see things that I think we were marketingized out of, like things we used to know changed through propaganda disguised as entertainment, disguised as commercials, that chipped away so that parents have one view of the world and their children have an entirely different one. They haven't seen the things you've seen and they don't understand them the way you do. And one of the shifts I see that has been most impactful recently is one that I don't think most people want to hear, in my opinion. And this is all my opinion and it's all some stuff I've been talking about. But when I was coming up, Black politics was not a part of the political party system. Black politics existed outside. Black people were, whether they were Panthers, whether they were Martin Luther King, whether they were Malcolm X, it was always agitating against the government to get the government to do the right thing. However, over time, as people accomplish things, then the opportunity to try to advocate from within the party, especially the Democratic Party, became a reality. So, of course, people flocked to that party. And the only reason that they flocked to that party was because that party was at least listening. The Democrats at least listened and optically aligned, even though if you go back and look at who voted for the Civil Rights Act, it wasn't about Democrats or Republicans. It was about Southerners and Northerners. Back then, Republicans had moderates and liberals. They mocked their limousine liberals, the Rockefeller liberals. And these were people who had a lot of money a lot of the time, but they still had a more liberal social view. They all voted for the civil rights, and all the Southerners didn't. The conservatives in both parties didn't. And so even though the titles and stuff have changed, the reality is still the same, except for the fact that over time, and with the election of Barack Obama, Black activism became part of the machine. So now you are part of the problem, and there is no more agitating outside to get the movers and shakers inside the party to bend to your will. It's a whole different mindset, because everything that comes out of the party has to be homogenized for everybody. When you are advocating against the system, you can be single focused. You can be about what you're about. I don't give a shit what you're doing for this and that people over there. I'm here to ask you, tell you, and show you why you should do the things I need you to do. And with that change, getting to where we are now was obvious. That was just obvious. It was going to happen, the backlash against the people who, even among people who are my friends, I've heard them say horribly racist things that they just took for granted. Yeah, you know, the first nipple I ever sucked was a Black woman. I loved my mammy. They're still saying shit like that. They still say that kind of shit today. We see how whole white America lost their minds because they took mammy off the pancake box. So if you're in absorbed into the machinery of patriarchal white supremacy and suppression of everything that doesn't fit into that worldview and stay in its place within that worldview, it's a whole different game. It's a whole different way of looking at this. And when the election of Barack Obama came about, it was seen by some people and a lot of people as a get out of racism free card. If we elect a Black man, we can't be racist, which is just a bald-faced lie. Just what you said, what you just thought, that's racist. That doesn't erase anything, and it doesn't in itself change anything. Everything you know is a lie, a deliberate bald-faced lie. For example, you hear people arguing about whether the United States is a democracy or a constitutional republic or a fascist state, and it's none of those things. The United States is a plantation. It always has been, you know, one nation, indivisible. It's always been a plantation hierarchy. The South planted cotton. The North built plants to process that cotton. The South bought slaves. The North sold, financed, and insured them. So whether your big house is a White House for a president or an estate for a governor or CEO or massa, same fucking same. I said before that America is a plantation. We look at it as a lot of different things, but it is a plantation, whether North or South. The corporate structure is just an industrialized plantation structure. As far as the social hierarchy, the workforce, everything, the structure of the CEO or master in the big house is in the big house in the secluded, but it's all the same. And if you are trying to, if you are on the plantation and you change overseers, it don't change the plantation. And nobody black would have told you before the election of Barack Obama that America was not a plantation, that it was a white supremacist country. Black people, there were black people still advocating against that. And so they changed overseers. And here's something else you won't like. As hard as he tried not to be, he was cast, Barack Obama, as a black man. And I get that, why he might self-identify as a black man. That makes this no problem. But he didn't run as a black man. He ran as a colorblind because he couldn't get elected any other way. And so that with the addition of nullifying all the voices of resistance in the black community, they had to be quiet, because had you spoken up, he couldn't have been elected, which in itself is racist. However, it's seductive. And depending on how you look at it or handle it, it could be very, very beneficial. But the more colorblind you are, the less effective you're going to be, and the less agitators on the outside of the system that there are, the less effective the community is going to be. So to be forced to disassociate with Jeremiah Wright or not get the nomination was the real strong signal that what I'm saying is true.
We took this country by terror away from the Sioux, the Apache, the Arawak, the Comanche, the Arapaho, the Navajo. Terrorism. We took Africans from their country to build our way of ease and kept them enslaved and living in fear. Terrorism. We bombed Grenada and killed innocent civilians, babies, non-military personnel. We bombed the black civilian community of Panama with stealth bombers and killed unarmed teenagers and toddlers, pregnant mothers and hard-working fathers. We bombed Gaddafi's home and killed his child. Blessed are they who bash your children's head against a rock. We bombed Iraq. We killed unarmed civilians trying to make a living. We bombed a plant in Sudan to pay back for the attack on our embassy, killed hundreds of hard-working people, mothers and fathers who left home to go that day not knowing that they never get back home. We bombed Hiroshima, we bombed Nagasaki, and we nuked far more than the thousands in New York and the Pentagon, and we never batted an eye. Kids playing in the playground, mothers picking up children after school, civilians, not soldiers, people just trying to make it day by day. We have supported state terrorism against the Palestinians and black South Africans, and now we are indignant because the stuff we have done overseas is now brought right back into our own front yards. America's chickens are coming home to roost.
So we have to realize we gave up something to get something, which you always do. But we have to be honest about that and realize that the cost of doing that, what you had to put on the table to get what you want, was to still the voices of progress and absorb the ones who would be still. And so we find ourselves in this situation right now where there seems to be a chokehold, a white supremacist chokehold on everything. And everybody wants to know, well, somebody do something. Somebody do something. Well, the people who were doing it got pushed to the curb. Y'all said they was too militant. They're too violent. They're the problem. They were not the problem. They were never the problem. But when you have the school system teaching that, when you have the media depicting that, and you have children growing up learning that, it's not a surprise that we are where we are. And we have to be honest about that. And we have to be honest about exactly this country we live in. And we have to be honest about the fact that Black people are Americans too. This is our country too. You are, we are not objects for you to work for your benefit. We've never been that. And so as an American, I'm pissed off at all of y'all. And the ones who get caught up on these social media sites, which are all owned by the patriarchy now. They are all owned by patriarchal white supremacy. They are all aligned in maximizing the plantation profit. And you trying to get a bag and you trying to get in any, you in the system, you supporting their system. So listen to old lady. We have to figure out a way to counter this. And why my way is I have founded my own political party. It's called the Marshocratic Party. And here in the Marshaverse, we are Marshocrats. And if you would like to join, feel free. We could use you here. Stand up. The 92% who told you so, who all told you this in what I'm saying in different words. They said the same damn thing. They told you what was going to happen. If you want to stand with those people against both sides trying to fight over who gets to control you, join the Marshocrat Party. You have a voice and you have a claim. Because as a woman who birthed these people, all of these people had mothers. So they can all be called in the in on the carpet. You'd explain yourself. And you have the right to be mama and stop being the missus. And fuck all that. Sit down and tell me something. And so if you believe in the Marshocratic method, join us. I have a degree in sheology. And of comediosophy from the Warfield School of Comedy at MFU. And so I know what I'm talking about, and I'll be talking about other things later, but I've been running off my mouth for so long, my guest is probably asleep. Oh, poor baby. Anyway, you loved him on television. He was the cutest person on TV in 1978-79. And he was always adorable, and his personality was always infectious, and you just wanted to hug him. And of course, when he would come on TV and go, hey, 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 we all at home went, oh, hey, 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 they're just like him. I ran into him at an event we'll talk about in a minute, but I want you guys to give a big round of applause to my guest tonight, Haywood Nelson.
Damn.
Hi, baby.
Hi.
How are you?
Well, look at me.
Good. Yes,
middle of the night, hanging out in the verse. I'm loving it.
You look, you know, I'd recognize you anywhere. You still have the same infectious face. Do you know that? Or have people told you that you just seem like somebody they could just walk up to and, hey, give me a hug, you know? You just have that kind of spirit.
I hope so. I mean, yeah, I hear it, Marsha, you know, but that is not by design. I'm just chilling, trying to keep myself healthy. You know, you've spoken to a few things that resonate. You know, I'm 65, so I was born in 1960, so 6 years after you, right, but came through the 60s, remembering it. Born and raised in Harlem, so I saw a lot of change.
But we don't ever talk about how exciting and how whole generations created so much out of nothing, created whole movements that have renaissance and that whole hip-hop industry. Now, it's not just a business. Well, it's a whole exported around the world. They made out of, you know, mama's old stereo and old albums and created a whole fashion industry, all kinds of things in the Schomburg Museum at the library in Harlem.
Sure.
All these institutions. Now, we don't hear about that and celebrate that in the same way we do. Yeah, there's a problem of this and that. Sorry, man. I think from growing up in Chicago, the good far outweighs the negative. And so
in America, but that's not what we get fed.
So how do we fix that?
I've talked about this for a long time. I like you, and I agree with you. This has been a plan. It's been forever. You know, spent a lot of time in the earlier days with Ralph Carter, Michael from Good Time. Very, very bright, very intelligent historian and educator. And the people around him, you know, John Henry Clark, you know, spending time with Chancellor Williams and all these different scholarly men and women who do something that in answer to your question, I have now picked up, they write. But if you have any wits about you and you're going to write, you don't just write. You don't just bleed on the page like you may pass gas or, you know, let the contents of a bad meal out. You research it. You do a little research. You find out what others have said. I don't care what their ethnicity is, because some of the biggest truths about Black people in America come from European scholars who have pushed back against their own historical irrelevance. And they come in and peer-reviewed, they speak truth. Yeah. One of the biggest things that Ralph spoke a lot about, John Henry Clark spoke a lot about, and I picked up on the miseducation of everyone. It's a big problem.
Yeah,
the truth is out there. But when you've got a world society, well, man, it's really an American.
Yeah, but America loves to globalize everything. So.
Yeah, but, and that's the problem, because it's really an American problem, but then it's gotten globalized. When you've got one group that, through this miseducation, has a superiority complex, where they believe that contribution to civilization is greater on their side or by their people than any other. And then concurrently, you have a miseducation of the other groups that they have an inferiority and don't feel, even if they don't know this is what's suffering, don't sure. feel that they come from a culture that has a greater contribution to civilization. When you got these polarized views trying to coexist, you're gonna have problems.
Yes, and one of the things I hate the most is that we expect conflict. Our social media interactions celebrate and encourage yeah. conflict, and people want to sit down and debate stuff. I don't want to debate anything with you. Debate means that we're combatants. We're opponents. If we can discuss things, but there has to become an expectation of civility and collaboration. But now, you were a child actor in the 70s. 60s.
Because I began in 1965 at 5 years old.
How did you get it start? What made you? Was this you pestering your parents or your parents saying?
I was busy watching and enjoying my little G.I. Joes and crashing my mother's Avon perfume bottle cars, classic cars that were in the shape perfume bottles in the shape of a classic car. And my brother and I playing crash up cars with her stock and getting yeah. beat when she come home because we done messed them up. They done broke up. There's glass on the floor. They done spilled on the floor. The wax on the beautiful wax bare floors in Harlem in the projects is now no longer waxed. It has to be rewaxed okay. from that can that she would pour out. And, you know, but no, I, my godmother went to, she had an Irish man that she worked with. She was real close with him. And his sister, I think it was, or one of his relatives, was a manager. And, you know, she had a pretty fast, up-and-coming, successful management company, but no Black children. So she pretty much sent her relatives out, hey, see if you can find people you know that, you know, you like, that they may have someone. So anyway, that moved forward to that question being asked. I remember the day I was like maybe 5, going on 6. But my mother said, well, I don't know, let me ask him. And she asked me if I wanted to, you know, be on TV and do commercials. And she pointed to the television. I looked, I'm like, okay, I don't know. So we go down and we met Kathy Dow, real 4'11". I mean, first of all, I had my mother, Maxine Nelson. She was fiery. I grew up in a home with a strong Black mother with West Indian roots. So she had a tendency to pop you real quick and hit you with a shoe.
Yeah.
But I get down there and I meet this other, probably one of the first times I met a white woman who didn't act white in my definition as a kid. She was just this strong woman.
Right.
And, you know, we met, we hit it off. And I remember her asking my mom to step out of the room if she didn't mind and let the two of us talk. And we hung and we really got along. So, you know, went, did photo shoots, you know, the usual pattern that you do coming in. And she was going to have me go for auditions for commercials. But the one thing she said to me, and it's always stuck with me, you know, I'm going to send you into this, you know, we're talking about the Mad Men era, you know,
right.
We're talking about Madison Avenue, you know,
right.
White advertising. She said, I'm going to send you in for these roles for white children. When you walk in that room, they're going to look at you quite differently. They're going to be quite shocked, and they're going to give you a hard time. She said, but here's what I want you to do. When you get there, you're going to look at your sides or the little script that they go over it with your mom. They'll let her kind of talk to you about what it's about. After you get that, I want you to now leave that and come up with your own decision about what to do about it, how to be. Go in that room. I don't want you to think about what they say. I don't want you to think about what they're thinking about. I don't want you to do what you think they want you to do. You go in and do what you felt. If you don't get it, don't worry about it, honey. I'll send you up for the next one, because what's for you is for you.
Okay.
And I booked everything.
Well, you're adorable. Now look at you. Look at
it
that
was the
face.
Confidence, though.
Yeah, but you walk in the room with that face and that attitude and that you missed. Of course, you got it. But now you say you started in commercials, and of course, this was before the advent of the Burrell agency and people coming through that after the power, Black Power movement opened those doors and stuff. Yeah. So you started in commercials. Did you know Kim Fields at that
time?
I
met Kim many, many, many years later when I was doing Grady, the spinoff of Sanford and Son.
Okay.
And then Kim was, no, when it started What's Happening, Chip Fields and I, we read for Good Times, her as Thelma, me as Michael. And we screen tested for quite some time for Norman Lear. And then I know that Chip went on and moved on to some other things. I stuck around, Bernadette Stannis came in, and we screen tested together. And for the most part, thought I was going to be Michael from Good Times. We flew home together, you know, my mom, Bernadette, myself. Only to be told a couple weeks later by Kathy Dowd, it's okay, honey. They went in a different direction. And I'm glad they did, because they went with Ralph Carter from Raisin on Broadway. I then went to Broadway. And he was exactly the perfect one that they could have picked to play the militant midget. And then from there, I went to Broadway for a couple of years, and Broadhurst Theater, Longacre Theater, and then on into Sanford and Son. But Kim, I got to meet her because Chip Fields was friends with Cheryl Cheryl Pelt. Okay. And Tim Pelt. And that's Daniel Spencer's parent.
Oh, rest in peace.
Yes, yes, no doubt.
Bless her. Yeah. She is adorable. Wonderful. But you said the magic word, Norman Lear. Let me ask you the equal and opposite question. Did you know Eric Monte?
Not at that time. Met him later. I didn't know Eric.
And you didn't know any of the history that was going on? Because that was a big scandal at the time.
Sure.
Shirley did stand up. Shirley Hemphill, rest in peace. Rest in peace. And Shirley was, we were all rooting for Shirley. But then there was this other drama going on with Eric Monte and his lawsuits and the show not being picked up and then being picked up and all kinds of that drama. And you were unaware of that?
I was oblivious. I had no idea. And in fact, you know, that is something as an adult that I keep a check on, because there were numerous points in my life where that oblivion is relevant. I mean, for instance, the 60s, I'm right up in the middle of it. I mean, Malcolm is right down the street on the corner talking. Martin Luther King is assassinated. I remember I was sitting in my classroom and they made an announcement over the loudspeaker, because I went to PS 161, which was 129th Street and Amsterdam Avenue. I didn't know who that was. Yet my family all knew. They were very active, but I was kind of sheltered from that. But from that day on, it was like, I'm now awake. So now I'm going to find out who that is. And of course, it was so, you know, prevalent. But you know, kind of caught up in doing what I'm supposed to do as an actor, wearing that hat. I really wasn't even aware of a lot of political things going on. I mean, Vietnam, I knew a lot about, because I had relatives that were, I remember my cousin Larry was on the USS Forrestal when it was bombed. And I was like, for the first time, like, really paying attention. Like, whoa, Larry's on that boat and it's burning. He could die, you know. And so when it came to doing with Grady and then doing Cooley High, the TV series that becomes What's Happening, I didn't know that Eric Monte was. What I remember is when they asked us to come up with a different name for this. I didn't know why. Okay, that's cool. And I'm saying, I thought I'm doing Cooley High. What are we going to change the name now? I'm Pooter. Yeah. I got to come up with another name.
See, and that brings up the point that you are part of this history that needs contextualizing, that we don't always get to hear. And me and you could be a whole show for hours because there's so much more I think we could talk about that we both lived through. I ran into you most recently at the tribute for Ronaldo Ray, who there's another story that it's getting its own showcase, you know, through the documentary that we were there to be part of. But you and your wife and my wife, they seem to get it all.
What a great time. We had a good time.
You know, but that, all of that is, you know, part of our lives, but it's also part of the history that needs to be part of the record from the people who lived through. And like you said, we musically, all of the events, the Vietnam War, the AIDS crisis, there are so many things.
So many.
That we have a perspective on that nowadays when there's a chokehold being, like I said, put on our media where false equivalence obliterates truth. We need more than anything to at least put something on the record that people can come back to and maybe find a guidepost if they can't find the whole story. So I appreciate you coming here and sharing this time with me tonight, especially tonight when things are so dire and I am so down, or at least I was before you brightened up my whole.
Well, Marsha, let's keep writing.
Yeah.
And keep the Marshaverse, because while we can write, a lot of the young folks don't feel that as their source any longer. It's not their watering hole, so they don't really read as much, but they will come to the Marshaverse and listen. So, well, but I think we have to do both.
The mother's door is open. And that's before you go, my two sons are sitting backstage and they just want to, you know, talk to you and just talk to you. So I'm going to bring them out and and have them come out. And then we're going to let you get out of here. But first, I want you to meet my oldest son. You've met him. He's a producer of this show. So please say hello to Stephen Roberts.
Yes, sir.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Good.
Did you grow up watching what's happening?
Oh, man. I have been, when I greeted Haywood backstage, I've been doing my very best to not be a fanboy and keep it professional, but I can't tell you how thrilled I am to get to talk to him. But, you know, people don't understand what kind of life I get to live, because this past summer, well, first of all, the past 10 years I've been hanging out with a woman named Marsha Warfield, who I also watched when I was a kid, and now we're very, very close. This summer I have spent my time with Elaine Boozler, and several more who I can't
Martha
say
Wise.
Right now. Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's just unbelievable. But Haywood.
Anna Marie Horsford.
Yeah.
Kind of people like yes. That. But before we get you, you know, to have to scrape you off the ceiling.
Yes.
I want to bring your brother out. He's my baby boy, my problem child. He's in Chicago right now, our hometown.
Yes.
With Miss Lunell, I believe. And he's here with us tonight. And so please say hello to Skills Hudson.
Oh, wow. Hey. Hello.
Did you grow up watching me?
Yeah. Work? Yes. Okay. And what was so amazing, man, like full circle, is that before, like I was always a fan of the show. And then when I got the opportunity to see, they were in the front row of a show at Lunell's show, and you know what I'm saying, and I got to make them laugh, and you know, and it was just great, you know what I'm saying, to I'm glad that I didn't notice them to after I had already made them laugh, so I wouldn't fan out, you know what I'm saying, too hard right there on stage, because after I already made them laugh, I'm like, oh shit, that's who it is, or I ain't gonna look over there the rest of the time I'm on stage. And then the thing about it is, growing up, you know what I'm saying, just your whole everything, you're acting. But I used to get that thing about your smile. I used to get that a lot. Me, that just opened up a lot of doors and stuff for me. Just me because my smile.
Yeah, brother. Oh, yeah. And you're a nut. I love that part.
Oh, so you know him.
Oh, I know.
Do you, either of you, have a question or something you want to say?
Yes, and I apologize for asking you a question that you probably get asked all the time, but I have to ask it, and that is, where did your signature entry line that our mother has said twice so far that I will refrain from saying, but where did that come from? Was that yours? Was that in the script? Where'd it come from?
No, it's my name. I'm Haywood.
Yeah.
And most people in the industry call me Wood. They go, hey, Wood. My name's Haywood. So actually, first of all, I watched Fat Albert.
Uh-huh.
So I'm part of this junkyard band.
Yes.
You know, I like that, you know. Hey, and that's growing up. But when I did Grady, they used my name as a character, which I thought was awesome. First time that had ever happened. But how can I be playing Haywood? And I'm like, you know, as a young kid, it didn't make sense to me. But I went along with it. They wrote the character where he would tell jokes that no one would laugh at but him. And after he laughed, he would say, hey, hey, Haywood.
Oh.
So when I got to what's happening, I'm first show, pilot, live. Like, okay, I'm back live. I'm used to this. Broadway, Grady. Let me look through. Oh, look at the crowd. They're pumped. I got, you know, they want me to say, hey, rerun, hey, Raj, what's happening? When I come in the door, I went, I wear pro keds. I have street cred. I cannot go in there and go, hey, rerun, hey, Raj, what's happening? That's corny. I'm not doing that. I said, I got something for them. I opened that door. I said, I'm probably going to get in a lot of trouble, but I got to go for it. And I walked in there and I ripped one. Hey, hey, hey. And the crowd went. Hey. And I was like, yeah. And then the producer's like, that was great. Do that again. Do that every week.
Leave that in. It was not only a signature, it was a call. It's a beautiful moment, should be in the Smithsonian. African-American yes. history, just that sound should just be
about
there.
A call to bringing folks in, bringing everybody.
So much.
Summer of that year, when that first broke out, I went and stayed with my grandmother in Amarillo, Texas. And there were two kids on the block, white kids, by the way, who that was what they did from now on. Whenever they saw their friends, they did the hey, hey, hey.
Hey, hey,
that,
hey.
That was the thing. I mean, everybody did it.
Yeah, well, really, you know it, and it makes you smile. When you hear it now, it just makes you happy.
And that's what it was designed to do. And then people ask me to say, they say, oh, I know you're probably tired. I go, no, you don't get it. I'm the one that came up with it. and it comes out sometime when something really great happens. It will come out. It's just all the right. way it is.
And I'm not ashamed no more. It just makes me happy. Yeah, Skills?
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. Well, I didn't have a question. What I was surprised to hear during the interview is that that you had the opportunity to read for the part of Michael. That was interesting to hear that, you know what I'm saying? And to know like certain parts in like, yeah, now when you said the militant,
but what do you say? Look, militant midget.
Yeah, militant midget.
You know.
Okay.
It was him.
But now, did you see Cooley High?
Oh, it's one of my favorite movies of all time. I love the movie. When I was told Whitney Mayo, Grady. Whitman Mayo, when we were canceled, the Grady Show was canceled rapidly. He pulled me aside and says, hey, you stay up. I want you to go back to New York and I want you to read for something really important. I go, okay. I thought it was odd at the time, you know, and I addressed this in, you know, I have a book right now. I have actually two that I'm completing where I address it, where I was accustomed to the way things go. They go through my management to my mother to me, or agent to management to mother. To me, was he coming directly to me? This is interesting. And he was a lot more personable and very personal to him. I was like, okay. We jump on the plane, you know, back then it was first class, you know, here we're back. You know, I know I'm going to get me a vanilla ice cream with the chalk hot fudge on it. Hello.
Okay.
It was then it was revealed to me that it was Cooley Hawk. That start doing my prep work before I get there. So by the time I got there, I already knew the character Pooter real well. I mean, he got the gorilla shit thrown on his shirt.
Yes, he did.
To, you know, ugh. And then now everybody's in one end of the train car and he's in the other by himself. I knew that feeling. Okay, I can rock this. And I did. So to come back and then be able to be in that series was an honor. The movie to me was very powerful. I loved it.
Yeah, I loved it too. And I was just starting to do stand-up when they were, in fact, one of the comics, the one who played the white guy, was a comic out of Chicago named Jimmy Wigg. And that was right before I left, like in 75. I left in 76 and went to Los Angeles, but Cooley High was a really big deal. So the hell are you? And I am so happy to talk to you. And we need, do y'all know Ronaldo?
Yes.
Know Ronaldo? You met him?
Yeah, I performed with him in Victorville.
What'd he tell you?
He told, this cognac is not for you. In the green room. You're like, no, this is not for you, young man.
No, that ain't good. That munching motherfucker ain't getting yes. Did you know he was a teacher? Did you know he wrote Superman Lover? Did you know he was always a mentor to everybody
who
was willing to listen to him? He was a friend. I met him, I think, the first time he came from Ohio to Chicago. I was still working in Chicago, brand new comic, and then met him out in L.A. And so his documentary, the name of the documentary is, what is it? Ronaldo Ray Story, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Yeah. So if you can find it, give it a look. Everybody's, you grew up comedy-wise knowing is in it, and it's interesting, and it's a labor of love kind of project. Heywood, like I said, there's so much more, but I appreciate all you've given us your time tonight. Thank you so much, and thank you for sitting through my rant and listening to me vent and get things off my chest.
We need
and
more.
And sharing, you know, your part of history. And what you say you're writing. Tell us about your books.
Yeah, it's important we've lived, you know, when you get to our ages, you've been around, you've seen a lot, you've done a lot. I've got one, Diamond in the Rough, Nurturing Your Child's Scar, written for parents. I think it's important. We too often hear about child stars not doing well. You know, as they get to become adults, if they make it that far, they end up going in different directions, and we've lost a lot of them.
Yeah.
I think it's important that parents understand that when they have that one artist, that gifted one in their presence, they have to recognize who they are and what they are. They're not the same as, they're not better than, they're not the same as others. They, for the most part, young performers come here already knowing who they're ready, and most kids anyway, but especially the young artistic, those artists, they have their own universe within our physical, and you're not going to change that. And as a parent, I don't think that's the job. That doesn't mean that they shouldn't be disciplined, you know, and guided, but you're not going to change that universe that is their reality. You have to find ways to try and enhance it, gift them with what they need, so that they can be better at it. But then beyond that, there becomes the other side of it. Because this is not show business, this is business show. So there needs to be someone who's looking at the business side of it, making sure that financially they're taken care of and straight, that their hard work is not, you know, in vain, so that later on in life they can do more of what they already see as their reality. In the case of Danielle Spencer, she was a phenomenal child actor, timing and everything. However, she was always a veterinarian, always. Yeah. Even when I was teaching her how to boogie board in Malibu, and we're out there swimming, and I'm saying, we got a wave, let's go, we're gonna catch this wave. She's over there messing around with a little sand crab, flipping it over. She always knew who and what she was. So it's the parent's job to know, and not every parent does know, most don't. So I'm gonna write a book, and I'm gonna address a lot of the many issues and milestones that they should look for, and how they can be better prepared to help that one young performer along. The other one is just about what's happening in my relationship with what we talked about tonight, my path up to Cooley High, the TV series. The controversy behind it no longer being Cooley High, the TV series, is becoming what's happening. And then my relationship with each of the cast members that I worked with, which was each very unique.
That's a challenge. We had to come back again and tell and somebody talk to me about that. Last question. Did you know Malcolm Jamal Warner?
I did. I mean, not like we hung out and all. I was very familiar with the whole cast and the people there. Yeah. Heartbroken at his loss, especially because I am, people who know me, they know two things about me aside from being an actor. I'm very technical. I work in this industry in a lot of capacity, camera, lighting. Of course, I'm a writer. I've been in film distribution foreign. I do LED wall programming today.
Okay.
In Vegas, you know, I'm a tech person, but I'm also an adventurer. I've always been. Borderline, you know, survivalist, you know. A little bit.
That's where you lose me. I'm with you on the tech, everything, all that. But
I'm a little edgy when it comes to that. I love the ocean. I'm a diver. I was an underwater camera operator. I swim. I surf. So to lose my brother to the ocean, which is mother.
Yeah.
You know, my mommy water.
Okay. Know? Okay. No, you didn't say mommy water. I could love you more. So much in my mind, I want to talk to you and share with you, sit back on the couch and sip champagne. We have to do that. But thank you again for staying up with us tonight.
Yeah, much love to all of you. And thank you for having me in the verse. I love the music.
Oh, please visit anytime. Drop by. Just give me a call. This is home. I love you madly.
Love you too.
Take care.
All right now. You know, skills, Stephen, all my heart.
Oh, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, good night, honey.
Good night.
Say hi to your wife for me.
Will do. You too.
Okay. I will. So, that was amazing.
That was amazing.
Yeah, okay. Y'all can relax and breathe normally now.
It's my goodness.
You know, I was feeling awful, like I said, when I started tonight, just the way looking at the world and the lack of clarity and whatever that's going on. But I feel a lot better now, even though nothing's changed. We should bottle him.
Yeah. You
know, put some hey in a bottle and just play it whenever there's a, you know, occasion. What'd you say? In the bottle.
Hey, in the bottle.
That was Roy. Who was that? Roy Ayers in the bottle?
It was some song. Genie in the Bottle. Genie in the Bottle.
I don't know that song. There's another song.
You know that song. You've been a genie in a bottle before.
Stephen ain't paying no attention to you. So
I don't even know who you are.
So as I said earlier, I've started my own political party, the Marshocratic Party. If you want to be a Marshocrat, all you have to do is declare. We need to get together and come up with our own agenda, one that addresses the needs of all of the people who never get consulted, who never get because they don't bring a whole lot of money. They bring more bodies and humanity. And so the decision making that gets made eliminates the humanity and just goes for the money. We need to bring the humanity back. And so we need the Marshocrat party, Marshocrats. And I had a project that I've been working on. I know I've been promising to get it done, a web series companion that's part of this show, but also stands alone, called Truth Hunter Adventures of a Time Traveling Gym Teacher. And I've been working on a lot of things, but I want to do it all AI, because I believe we need to invest in this technology. Everybody needs to be conversant with it, because if you leave it to other people, all that gets fed into the algorithm is other people's stuff. Because it's all owned by right-wing supplicants, if not sycophants, it's going to have a bias anyway. But perhaps if we all get involved and use it, at least we won't get totally left in the dark. And so I and it's a wonderful tool now, especially since the studios, you know, they're losing influence and it's harder for people to get projects greenlit and stuff. Whereas, like, for me, it's easy for me to write the show, but to mount it is a different thing. And I could either wait, try to sell it to somebody or something, or I can make the show. I can make it now with the technology we have. And one of the things that I've been working on, Truth Hunter is her name. Her name is Truth Hunter. And she is a gym teacher and a successful gym teacher. But she is a history buff, a Black history buff, and she uses it to motivate her students. She teaches at a African-American prep school on the south side of Chicago. And so she, to give them their sense of identity, she tries to make sure they're aware of their history. And so through the magic of creativity, she sometimes time travels back to moments in history. And in this one picture that I generated, she has awakened at the March on Washington, and her expression being somebody from 2025 in the midst of the March on Washington is accumulation of all she knows and has learned, you know, in her lifetime, passed down from that event, to the wonder of actually being in that moment and feeling the energy and the reality and determination and hope that had to be in that crowd, as well as the, you know, constraints that were being put on them as far as they had to be out by 6 o'clock. There were other forces who did not want them there. And I mean, it was a lot of stuff going on in the energy of waking up, of going, you know, someplace in 2025 and then waking up as a 35-year-old woman at the March on Washington has to be a pretty amazing thing. And in the picture that you see, I think the AI captured that, you know. But it's a whole series. Like I said, I don't have a problem writing it. It's it's me. It's us. It's everything I've been working toward. And it's just that mastering this technology that grows every fucking day, every day. Right now, for the average person, is more hopeful than it is realistic. But every day there's some new thing you can do that I encourage everybody to lose your skepticism and forget about all you're going to lose, because time marches on, and embrace it so that you don't get left behind and end up with nothing but other people's opinions trying to shape yours. So I think I've seen you, Skills, try to put more AI stuff. Have you been playing with it?
Yes, I have. I have the ChatGPT, letting it give it ideas and just telling them what, like, hey, can you do this? I'm like, yeah, send me this. And I'll send them pictures or what's the name, or they just, so yeah. And like you said, it almost seems like it's overwhelming because of what you feel like you're used to, and you know what I'm saying? And, you know, so it seems like it's overwhelming, but also it's fun at the same time, because it's like, wow, nothing is, it's no cap on anything of your imagination.
Yeah, that's true. Have you used it, Steve?
Lots. I use it for a lot of flyers and promos for just comedy in general, but just to reveal myself just a little bit, I've also used it a little bit in therapy.
Okay.
When ask you to draw something from a particular point of view or how you feel about something, I've actually used AI for that. And it's pretty spot on when you know exactly what it is that you want to express, and you want to express a particular feeling, and you know what it looks like. It's actually breathtaking the first time for me when I asked it to do something therapeutically, and it did it. And I was like, show the therapist, this is what I mean right here.
It is. It gives those of us who can't paint, draw, or nothing a blank canvas and tools to make our creativity come to life.
Right.
We have to learn how to use it efficiently, but it's unlike some people think. It's uniquely yours because it's only putting out what you put in it.
Right. I have a friend who was working with it early on, and people would say to him, well, that's not you. That's AI. AI just did that. And it's like, if it weren't for the individual saying the words, it would not come out this way. It's no different than any kind of technology used for the arts or for anything else.
It's like saying that painting's not yours. That belongs to the paint.
Yeah.
The paint did it. No, the paint didn't do it. Neither did the brush. I mean, you know, they did.
Well, it wouldn't sound like that if you didn't have a violin. Right.
You know?
Correct.
So, yeah, but I think it's a wonderful way to, and as the technology catches up and I catch up to the technology, I think I'll be able to use it in ways that I will enjoy. I hope hopefully other people will too. So y'all saw the speech today, did you, Pete?
Hegseth.
The drinker. Hegseth. And then President, you know, how can he have messed up hands, messed up tiny hands? He's got diseased tiny hands. I mean, this is not funny.
And a perfectly fine ear.
Oh gosh! But anyway,
are just fine.
Y'all saw that today. What'd you think? Come on, Skill, spit it out.
Man, I'm like, man, white people get away with anything.
You know, it's funny, but it's not funny.
No,
it's funny, but it's really not funny.
Yeah, because you get the gist of it. That like really, like, you know what I'm saying? It's like, where do we get where we be able to, like, the individual that we look at as supposed to be at the president that represents all of us? We don't grew up knowing that it was always going to be tension if you're not the person that's represented. But it's always been a certain call of decorum of that office, a certain respect that was given, you know what I'm saying, on both sides to a certain degree. All that's been cut out, and then nothing is honest about nothing. We always knew both sides had their little lies and stuff, but now the Republicans, everything they still tell you to your face a lie, and like, okay, you know, they doing it, but we doing it, but it's not the way that you doing it, looking at what I'm doing. What the fuck? Yeah.
Well, your president said he hated half the country, and he meant that. And he talks about the left like we're not part of the country, like we're enemy combatants. And he has declared war on blue states and blue voters.
And we know this because he has a Department of War.
Because he said so. He said those words.
Yeah.
There's nothing hidden about his agenda. And it's really disheartening to hear that. You know, a lot of people will say, well, I'm glad I'd rather hear it than know it. Well, you've always known it. But to actually come out and say that, it's just hard to understand why or how much we lost with that spirit of activism and agitation and holding politicians accountable.
Well, here's another paradox. So you have a party that is followed by about millions of Americans who claim to be patriot, who claim to be 100% red, white, and blue card-carrying Americans, who support the troops, who support America's quest in ruling the world or whatever that is, you know, but then they're supporting somebody who just dressed down the entire leadership of the entire military on unfounded, nonsensical subjects. I mean, what he said to them and what he proposed to them
He came in there and said, I ain't never came up in the room and no applause when I first came. What? Because we don't want to clap, motherfucker. We don't want to clap.
But the thing is that his level of disrespect of just calling them all in the same room is that every single one of our military leaders is now on a bullseye. Had anybody known that was going on and had nefarious motivations, they could have dropped a bomb on that building and killed our entire military leadership.
Or attacked any one of the places where they weren't.
Correct.
There was so much at risk. But
well, you know, we are here talking on a Tuesday. We record this show on a Tuesday. Who knows what's happening when we air it on Friday? Who knows where we're going to be 3 days, 4 days from now?
No. Well, that's what we do. We wake up in the morning and go, what did Ding Dong Donnie Dimwit do today? What he did today was made America weak, exposed an American weakness that nobody is talking about. And that's that he does not have the support of or the respect of the military force that he's trying to exploit. They do not support him as a group. They do not, we could tell from the parade and from the debacle today that they were not a MAGA crowd. They were, you know, whatever you think of America, they were Americans first and not MAGA first.
And soldiers.
So he showed the world that our military is being not only abused, it's against their will. They're not supported, and they're not being cooperative as you might think. He just exposed such a rift at a time when he is the biggest threat to America. It's not the left. It's not blue states. It's the part of America that would vote for a convicted felon who is being investigated for being a pedophile in one of the biggest pedophile cases the country's ever seen. It's the fact that he has lawsuits against him totaling billions. It's the fact that he led an insurrection, then got back into office and pardoned all of those people and enlisted them as ICE agents. He has done so much that we don't talk about, and very little of it, or any of it that I could think of, has been for the United States. He does not speak in terms of the United States. He talks about more than half of the country as enemies of the state. And it's hard to see a way around that when he's got the nuclear codes and has shown that he's willing to use them as he sees fit. It's enough to just send you into your bedroom in a fetal position.
Or Canada.
But somebody's got to stand up and at least say something, you know? And what the fuck? You know, like I said, I'm in my 70s. What I got to lose? I might as well say what the hell is on my mind and keep on keeping on. This is. And even for me, somebody who never had illusions of, you know, apple pie and mom and, you know, Norman Rockwell paintings and shit. I've never had those illusions, but this is way beyond comprehension.
Yeah.
And that nope, that he has people on his side willing to do his, carry his water and do his dirty work.
You ever watch those cartoons or those superhero shows where there's these really bad villains and they've got their henchmen with them and you think to yourself, how did that villain get those people to join him? He's so bad and he's doing such horrible things. How did he get those people to like be his minions? Like, how did he get them to do that? I look at those people and I think, what is in it for them? What are they getting out of this?
I can tell you when I started doing stand-up and I got to Los Angeles and then I went to San Francisco First time I went to San Francisco had to be about 77, 78. And that was like at the hippie movement. The hate was full of kids because I was going to run away from Chicago and go to San Francisco with no money because that was the allure, the thing they told you. You could come to San Francisco and just live on the street, man. You could be like free. And so I didn't do it quite that way. But the first time I went to San Francisco, Jim Jones was all the rage. He had lured so many people to the People's Temple or whatever they called it. And the assassination of Harvey Milk. What was the other man's name? Oh, Mayor Moscone.
Oh,
yes.
And in the mayor's office.
Time, yes, that was the first time I heard of Dianne Feinstein and what's her name? Nancy Pelosi. They were young politicians in San Francisco. So, you know, I've seen that kind of all of these people following this man. And then later, what happened with the Jonestown, I've seen that reality. But this is even that on steroids. This is, and that people are letting it happen. Is, you know, I think that's the smartest thing Kamala Harris said, is that I didn't envision the capitulation. I think that belongs on a t-shirt. Anyway, it's time for us to say goodnight. And remember, like, history museums are vitally important nowadays. And to preserve your history and the reality of your history, if you are one of those Americans that gets left behind for whatever reason, tell your story, write it down. Paint the picture, write the book, whatever it is that you can do to share truths that people will have to reference even long after we're gone. So change the narrative and you'll change this country. Thank you both so much. I don't know what happened to your picture, Stephen, but I'm glad you're here. And I don't think I'm going blind, Bridget. It's a little fuzzy. Anyway, I love you both. And I thank you for staying up. And I'll see you next week with a brand new show. And I think we'll end with this Native American compilation and let them speak about the America they love. Good night.
Native American is a person who is indigenous to North, Central, and South America, including the Caribbean islands and Greenland. These are the original peoples of the Americas, those whose ancestors inhabited these lands long before European colonization and the transatlantic slave trade.
In Canada, we are referred to as First Nations, Inuit, or Métis, collectively known as Aboriginal Canadians or Indigenous peoples.
In Canada, each group has distinct languages, cultures, and histories that have endured despite centuries of colonial pressure.
In the United States, we are commonly known as American Indians, Native Americans, or simply Indians.
These terms are often used interchangeably, although many individuals prefer to identify by their specific tribal nation.
In Mexico, we are called indígenas, which means indigenous people.
We are also called pueblos originarios, which means original peoples.
And sometimes indios, although the latter can carry colonial or pejorative connotations depending on context.
Throughout Central America, similar terms are used, indígenas being the most widespread.
Countries such as Guatemala, Honduras, and Panama recognize multiple indigenous nations,
like the Quiche, Garifuna, Lenca, and Guna, each with their own ancestral territories, spiritual systems, and social structures.
In South America, indigenous peoples are known by many names, depending on the region.
In the Andes, terms like Quechua and Aymara refer to specific ethnic groups with ancient empires and traditions. In the Amazon, names like Yanomami, Shuar, and Ashaninka represent forest-based nations whose ways of life remain closely tied to nature.
On the Caribbean islands, indigenous populations such as the Taino, Arawak, and Carib were among the first to encounter European colonizers. Colonization devastated many of these communities. Descendants still exist in places like Puerto Rico, the Dominican Republic, preserving traditions and reasserting their identity.
Despite being spread across two continents and countless ecosystems, Native Americans share common experiences.
Colonial invasion, forced assimilation, land dispossession, resistance, resilience, and cultural survival. And yet, a dangerous myth persists that indigenous people are no longer here, or that everyone is now mixed beyond recognition. This narrative is not only false, but harmful. It erases the continued existence of pure and sovereign indigenous communities across the Americas.
From the Tarahumara highlands of Mexico to the Quechua villages of the Andes.
From the untouched forests of the Amazon to the remote Dene and Inuit lands of the north. There are countless indigenous nations living with their languages, customs, and bloodlines intact.
Many of these communities live in isolation by choice, resisting assimilation, and maintaining deep spiritual and ecological relationships with their ancestral territories.
In countries like Bolivia, Guatemala, and Peru, millions of indigenous people speak their native languages as a first tongue. Entire municipalities and regions are governed by indigenous customs and laws. To say everyone is mixed is to ignore the very real presence of people who have preserved their heritage.
We are not extinct.
We are not relics. We are not myths or symbols in a textbook. We are nations. We are languages. We are ceremonies. We are families. We are protectors of the land. We are survivors. We are the first and the forever people of the Americas. To be Native American is not only to descend from the first inhabitants of this continent. It is to live in defiance of erasure. It is to carry the flame of memory forward, knowing that we are the living continuation of our ancestors.
Can do it like that. Her own style, no one can wear that hat. Hey, don't you know that the queen is back? She's back, she's back. She withstands the test of time. When it comes to strength, she comes to mind. But now she gets backed up again and again. I'm talking about Marsha.
Marsha.
You know you got it. You know you got it. No one can tell a joke like that. Got you laying on the ground.